Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Glory Glory Man United podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Quinn. And join me today to talk about United's draw at home to Liverpool in the Premier League is Chris Nugent. How's it going, Chris?
Not too bad, Kyle. Not too bad, mate. Thanks for having me on again. Looking forward to having a chat.
I think we're both a little disappointed given that United led the game remarkably, given how Liverpool dominated for just long spells. Basically, United scored two wonder goals, and Liverpool scored from a set piece and a penalty that was inexplicably given away by Aaron Wan-Bissaka. If we just address that first. Now, Wan-Bissaka, first of all, he's playing out of position. It's very hard for a right footer to play in that position. But I am frustrated with him in recent weeks, the way he's been played Ivan Toney onside for their equaliser. Real lack of concentration from him, giving the ball away needlessly. And then he always goes to ground. We know that on 95% of the time he wins the ball, but you don't go to ground in the box against a quick player like Harvey Elliott, who just got there first and Wan-Bissaka took him down. It's really, really frustrating that we basically drew the game because of that silly challenge inside the area. What's your thoughts on it, Chris?
It was a stinker, Kyle, an absolute stinker. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was like, you know, it was tight enough to hold out, when we were leading. And I was kind of thinking, we need to see this game out here. And in that situation, like you say, in the box, you don't go to ground. You try and stand up and read the guy and nip the ball away. Do you know what I mean? The last thing you do is go to ground. I thought it was really amateurish. I thought it was really silly. And it cost us really, even though I would say that overall we weren't the best team, but we could have won the game if he hadn't done that ridiculous challenge. So, yeah, very disappointing. At the minute, I don't think, like you said, Erkai, I don't think Wan-Bissaka's in a great vein of form at the minute. And I mean, I've criticised him in the past, but never about his defending, actually. I would always say he's a really, really good defender. But I don't think he was great today, actually. And it reminded me again today how little he offers going forward. He offers zero. He's so average going forward, so afraid to take any remote risks that he offers nothing. And if he's not defending well, then you kind of go, well, what is he actually giving to the team? So I was disappointed with him today. Very disappointing.
Yeah, I remember an incident down that flank where Rashford was on the attack and Wan-Bissaka came to support him. And it ended up Liverpool just dispossessed them and came away with the ball. And I was thinking, if Luke Shaw was there instead of Wan-Bissaka, that could have been a chance for United rather than Liverpool taking the ball off them and coming forward again. I was just thinking in that moment that we really missed, a proper left back like Luke Shaw.
Big time, but I know I mentioned the you during the week, and I come back to the game and then reflecting on it. You know, I was saying to you sort of joking that Gary Neville is better going forward than Wan-Bissaka. I know Gary Neville was sort of joking around about his prowess, but Gary Neville was all right going forward. And we've had a lot of defenders over the years who you wouldn't consider to be prolific going forward, like Gary Neville, who could at least offer you something. They could at least whip in a decent cross. You know, at least play a 1-2. They could do something. But Wan-Bissaka, frequency help for absolutely nothing. He literally will just give the ball away. Or he'll just run a few yards and then just for the same pass and then just drop off again. You know, he really doesn't offer anything at all. I think it's less than being average. I think he's poor going forward, actually. I go as far as he's poor. And he's one of the worst fullbacks going forward, I would say, that we've had in a long time. I find it very frustrating, I have to say.
And if he's not defending properly, then he's offering nothing. And that's a major issue. The problem is at the moment that both left backs are out, injured, and somebody has to fill in that position. I think he was played at left back because of his defensive abilities up against Mo Salah and did reasonably well in the cup fixture. But for the most part in the last couple of games, as Dalot has been at left back and Wan-Bissaka right back, which I think usually makes most sense, but today, because of the threat of Mo Salah, Wan-Bissaka played in that position. It obviously didn't really work out today because Wan-Bissaka cost us the points. But moving on from that now, United scored a couple of wonder goals, as I said at the top of the show. The first one coming from Bruno Fernandes when Kwanzaa gave the ball away, with Kevin Gallagher being way off his line, which Bruno spotted and basically lobbed the ball over him and into the net. It was almost an exact replica of Cavani's goal against Fulham in May 2021. That particular game I remember because it was the first time that fans were allowed back in after COVID, albeit it was only half the stadium was allowed, and Cavani scored very, very similar goal to what Bruno scored today. I have to say, I'm going to have to start criticising players more often, because that's 2-2 from Bruno, and I've been very critical of him this season, but he's starting to hit a wee bit of goals going for him, Chris. So what did you make of that goal?
You keep on criticising then, Kyle, if this is a result. Criticise all our worst players, maybe they'll start to play well. He took the goal brilliantly well. I thought Bruno played well today. I know we'll come on to player ratings later on, but actually, for the most part, I don't think we were great. And most players weren't particularly good, but actually I thought Bruno was pretty good today. And the goal was magnificent. When you've seen it from the angle, you know, his angle where it's behind him, that it's as much as it's a lob, it actually swerves almost towards the top corner as well. So the keeper actually think of it had to be directly over his head, may even have got it, but it just swerves away from him. So it was actually a brilliant strike in all, and took it really well. And that's one thing, you know, I do like about Bruno. He'll take them risks, you know, he'll do those things. He's cheeky enough to do it, and sometimes he gives the ball away, of course. But, you know, when it works out in moments like that, you're grateful that he does have that kind of... And he has kind of just the mindset to go for those kind of things and try what looks a wee bit cheeky. It was really good goal. He took it really, really well. It's good.
Yeah, it was great technique. And I think it was Roy Keane who said afterwards that he's the only player in the United team who would have scored that goal. And you know, he's probably right when I think about it. There's a few exactly. Might have tried it, but it wouldn't have came off.
No, exactly. That's it. He's got the cheek. You get the cheek to do it, and he's got the technique to pull it off. So, I mean, all in all, it was lovely. And again, against the run of play, I might say, you know, I don't think we were playing overly well today. So, yeah, it was good. It just and actually scoring a goal like that is a bit spectacular. Actually, gives the team a lift more than if I had scored a penalty or it was a tap in or something. You know, so in a way that it almost gave an extra lift to the team. So, it was great. It was great, to be fair.
And it came against the run of play because Liverpool really should have been more than 1-0 up. And then that mistake at the back cost them. And then United went 2-1 up, of course, with Kouy Maïnou scoring a goal that was very similar to Makeda's goal against Aston Villa in 2009, as everyone's been pointing out. But Kouy Maïnou, you simply run out of superlatives, don't you? I mean, what more is there to say at this point?
Yeah, he's incredible, like, for his age. Absolutely incredible. I heard in the commentary beforehand, I think it might have been Gary Neville or Jamie Carragher saying they thought he'd maybe, I think it was them, said they thought he dropped off a wee bit the last couple of weeks. But what a way to come back and just remind everybody just how much ability he has and how good he is and is going to be in the future. Brilliant. Took it really, really well. And I love to, I can't remember who it was beside him. They probably could have taken the ball off him, and I can't remember what player it was, just stepped aside, and you could tell they were just going, he's going to wind it up here. And it shows the confidence even in him that his teammates have. It's just sort of moved out of the way and just, you know, let him have a shot. What a finish, like, took it so well. Yeah, brilliant. He's a class act, I have to say. He's a great young player.
He's yet to score a tap-in.
No point in scoring tap-ins, going goals like that. Forget about tap-ins, they don't look good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All his goals have been spectacular, and you know, long may it continue. And we've waxed lyrical about his ability on the ball and how difficult it is to get the ball off him. But those goals are magnificent as well. And yeah, hopefully as he gets older, he scores more goals every season. Like, he's got 3 already, and he's only replayed half a season. But I imagine I think in the future he's going to play further up the pitch, you know. At the moment, United kind of, you know, using him as either a 6 or an 8. But I think he's got the ability to play as a number 10, you know. And I think in the future, that's where he will end up. If United get more of a specialist in there, a number 6, and, you know, Casemiro will probably move on. And United will get a younger version of Casemiro. And then I think Kobe will be pushed up further, especially when Bruno kind of, you know, Bruno's career will end a lot sooner than Manu's, given that they're 11 years apart. So I think, you know, when Manu's in his mid-20s, I think he's going to be our number 10. I think he's just that good. He can play anywhere in midfield. My only issue is the structure of the midfield, which we'll come on to later in the show. But yeah, Liverpool, very much like the cup game, the second half of the cup game, they totally dominated, didn't take their chances, and they were punished. And then the first half of this game, they totally dominated, didn't take their chances, and they were punished. And you can see the frustration from Jurgen Klopp every time they missed a chance, because he knew that when you don't put United to the sword, they'll come back. If you allow United to stay in the game, they can create problems, and that's exactly what happened.
100%. You know, I think I said it to you on a text before the game, is that, you know, United have the quality to beat almost anybody on their day, but they also have the flaws to lose to almost anybody. And that's the very frustrating thing about them. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me when United beat big teams like that, or, you know, they didn't win today, or, you know, we do have dangerous players who are as good in their position as probably anybody in the world and can win games for you. So, 100%, Kyle and Klopp and the Liverpool team will not have been too naive to realise that themselves. So, yeah, I mean, I felt like Liverpool battered us for the most part, to be honest, today. I think we got a lift after Bruno's goal, but I think up until that, they were pretty much battering us. But you're right, they weren't taking their chances. And, you know, when you have players like Bruno and Manu and Garnacho and Rashford, if he's in form, although it's been a long time since we've seen that, and Hoyland as well, you know, there's players that will score against any team. So, yeah, you're right, they didn't take their chances. And at the end of the day, yeah, they got punished for that, for sure. Liverpool fans, I don't know how they'll feel, whether they thought that was a good result for them or not. I mean, they'll obviously want the 3 points, but whether they thought they deserved it or not, I would have said overall they were a bit better than us, but you have to be clinical. You just get punished, and that's what happened. So yeah,
and the stats kind of reflect what we watched. They had 62% possession. They had 28 shots, and we had 9. That's again by United, the number of shots conceded is alarming. So it was 31 that Brentford got, 28 by Chelsea, 28 by Liverpool. And this is constant every week. It's so easy for the opponents to get shots off. So Liverpool had 7 on target to our 5, and they had 12 off target to 2. Ten Hag's excuse is that they're low-risk shots or low-percentage shots from outside the box, but those could fly in as well. You just can't allow people to shoot, especially players that quality. I mean, you've seen Alexis McAllister in midweek there against Sheffield United scoring from distance. You allow people the more shots you allow them to have, the more chance there is of going to score, obviously. So I don't agree with Ten Hag when he plays down the number of shots that United are allowing opponents to have. I feel they had way more passes as well. 567 passes to 356. And they had 5 clear-cut chances, and we had 1. They had 11 corners, and we had 6. Yes. And we had to make a lot more tackles than them.
I mean, overall, you know, and that, it's interesting you're giving those stats, Kyle. It reflects sort of, yeah, what I sort of felt watching the game as well. So I did notice that we weren't pressing them very hard, and we weren't closing the ball down a lot, and that speaks to that because, you know, lots of possession for Liverpool. It also speaks to what Ten Hag's saying, you know, parking the bus in some ways, and then that means they're going to have to shoot from outside the box. So I can see that reflected in the statistics, but you're right. I mean, you can't just sit back and play counter-attack all day and just let teams have shot after shot after shot, because some of them will go in. This is the Premier League. This is top-level football. You know, guys, you may say they're low percentage shots, but those guys taking those shots aren't taking them for the sake of having a shot. They're taking them hoping to score, and they're good enough to do it. And let's be honest, Onana was good today. But overall, you know, if I'm a player playing for an opposition team, I'm thinking I'm going to test Onana. I think there's a mistake in him. I think that he won't get to everything. You know, he's not De Gea. He's not going to pull off wonder saves all day every day. So yeah, shots from outside the box can be dangerous, and I don't think we're above thinking, you know, that they're never going to go in. So no, I agree with you. I would like to see us have more possession, close down the ball faster, make it more difficult for teams, not just, you know, let them kind of come on to us a wee bit. So Yeah, I can agree with you. Yes, I see Ten Hag's point, and it played out like that. But that was only by chance as well. There was a couple of today of chances that they have, and all it took was somebody in the right place or something, and it's a goal. So yeah, I don't think you can sit back and say, oh, it was fine. It was all under control. I don't think that is the case. So yeah, I think I agree with you, to be fair.
Yeah, and the biggest compliment I can pay to Onana is that we're not really talking about him as much anymore. And I suppose that's a good thing. You know, he was constantly dominating podcasts in the first half of the season, and now he's become a wee bit more anonymous, which is exactly what you want from a goalkeeper. You don't really...
Exactly.
We were quite often the last decade or so, we were talking about De Gea a lot because he had to make so many saves. And we're talking about Onana a lot in the first half of the season because he's making so many mistakes. But ideally, if you're a winning team, you're not really talking about the goalkeeper at all. Unless he has to make the odd save, so that's the way you want it to be.
Absolutely.
But United are chaotic in every game, and Gary Neville and Carragher were constantly pointed out today. Neville just couldn't believe the shape of the United team when Liverpool were in possession. They pointed out and how Casemiro and Manu were pushing up into the final third, which making it easy for the opposition. All they had to do is play one pass and our back four under pressure, because when our two midfielders are playing at the base of the midfield, they're pushing up very high. One Liverpool pass into that big wide open gap immediately has our defence under pressure. I think Liverpool had a 5v2 situation. They didn't score from that. And that happened a few times in the cup game as well. It seems as if Ten Hag is just willing to give up a lot of chances in order to create openings for United. It's almost like basketball in a way. He's playing very, very high-risk football. And as I said to you when we were talking during the game, you know, that makes for very, very entertaining games. But it's not a good recipe for consistency or being a successful team. United have been involved in 5-4-3s this season, I think, and many more chaotic games. And today was another one. You know, it was only 2 each, but it could have been much more. As I say, it's great entertainment, as even Roy Keane says, but it's not a recipe for success, is it?
No, it's definitely not. It's definitely not at all. I mean, the extreme of it is what we're seeing at Spurs at the minute with Postecoglou, you know, that, or what Marco Bielsa would have done at Leeds, you know, and that's not a recipe for winning trophies. It really isn't. You know, you need to be a bit more pragmatic than that. I think there's extremes, and, you know, if you go to the really defensive extreme, it's boring. So you don't want that either. But no, you're right, Kyle. I think if you're going to win trophies, you know, you have to have a bit more disciplined approach, shall we say, and a bit more balance in the team and in the tactics. So, yeah, I don't think it's a recipe for long-term success. But yeah, it is entertaining. But to be honest, for me today, well, I was going to say individual errors, but the penalty was for sure was an individual error, 100%. Their first goal, Liverpool's first goal, I don't even know who you would even blame for that. It was awful. I mean, I think we're playing a kind of a zonal marking, so maybe the manager. But I mean, was it Diaz that scored? Was absolutely free as a bird in the six yard box. I mean, if that happened in a Sunday league team, you'd be ripping, and the manager would say, "How did you just not mark the guy? He's one of their best players. Just mark him." So yeah, I found that one harder even to take, because he was just standing there free, not a single person marking him. People looking at him, looking at each other. I mean, that's just awful. So yeah, it was pretty bad. So yeah, I thought the goals today were down to sort of individual moments of poor kind of defending quality. But yeah, overall, like you said, Kyle, I think more balance is required if we're going to be successful.
Yeah, I think the zonal marking was to blame for that first goal. And I've never, ever been a fan of zonal marking. I remember all the way back
I can't understand how anybody is. I think it's terrible. It's so confusing. It really is.
I remember all the way back to Rafael Benitez at Liverpool used to adopt zonal marking from set pieces. And I thought, why? This is not going to work. You know, for example, all the attacker has to do is start at the edge of the box and then charge into the box, and he's going to have the momentum, whereas the player standing still is not going to have any momentum. You know, he's not going to be able to prevent the player running at pace, you know, attacking the ball. You know, a player who's standing still is not going to be able to stop him.
No, you're completely right. And on top of that as well, like I say, you know, and I've, you know, in my, you know, basic amateur days, I've played man marking and zonal marking, and I always hated it because it's confusing. You know, in a split second when you don't have a moment to think, and a player's entered into a zone, you know, it's kind of, whose player is he? What if he's in between zones? What if he's moved from one zone to the other? You know, the people keep jumping around. You don't have time to think in those fast-paced situations. So it's much simpler to just say, you have got a man, that's your man, and that's it. It's so much easier to understand and to actually implement in practice. So I just think zonal marking is a recipe for what happened today, where everybody's in their own zone. They're marking the player they think is in their area, and then somebody's kind of in an area, not in an area. Nobody really knows. And before you know it, it's too late. The guy scored anyway. So it's just, to me, I just don't like it. I don't see how it works. I think it's a bad approach.
Yeah. Manu was the closest man to Diaz, but he had his eyes on Salah. And then he was sucked into the middle, and Diaz was in space and was easily able to just tuck it away from about 6 yards out. You know, it's going to be...
And then you got, was it Dallow on the back post? But he's on the post. That's his area, is to be on the post. And you want a man on each post. So he does he come out? Does he not? Again, you don't have time to think. You know, by the time he's thought about, maybe I should go out because there's nobody else marking the guy, it's too late. And that's the whole problem with that approach. It's just too confusing. You just need a man on man. It's simple.
Another thing I noticed was it was clear from United's corners, and even pointed this out in commentary, that United obviously worked a lot during the week on Van Dijk from set pieces. Even when United had attacking set pieces, they had a lot of focus on Van Dijk. They were trying to block him off. They had somebody marking him, and then they had somebody trying to impede him. And they just obviously seen him as a big threat. But Liverpool have other players, and as we've seen with Diaz, you know, you just can't focus on one man, or somebody else is going to be in space.
No, that's it. And again, the easier way would have been to say you have one man on, you know, say Maguire, for example, you know, big guy, just you stick with Van Dijk or whatever it is, you know what I mean? Have an approach to Van Dijk, and but you know, don't just focus on him, you know, that's somebody's job, and then somebody else's job is something else, as you know, like you say, Kyle, as opposed to just, you know, just giving all your attention to him and don't let the cards fall where they may in other areas. I mean, yeah, it's just recipe for disaster, as we've seen. You know, it worked out badly.
Yeah, and we can't blame the set pieces coach anymore, because he's now the manager of Minnesota United. Eric Ramsey used to get it in the neck earlier in the season when we were conceding all these goals from set pieces. But anyway, I think an article was written by Stephen Railston in the Manchester Evening News, even back in April last year, that Ten Hag was actually taking more of a hands-on role with set pieces. So once again, we're going to have to blame the manager on this one.
Sorry to say again, but it's Ten Hag. Is it that kind of situation?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like I say, zonal marking, I hate it. I think it's a really bad thing, and today was the prime example. You know, you couldn't even blame a player. That's the thing. You're looking and going, whose man is he? He's actually nobody's man anyway, you know, because nobody has a man. He's in a given area, and there's nobody else to mark him in that area. It comes off really amateurish when it goes wrong, and that's how it looked today. It just looked really, really poor.
I seen Rio Ferdinand on the overlap in midweek, and one of the things he talked about was the David Moyes season, which was his last season at United. And he said at times the players were not completely sold on David Moyes' plans and tactics. He's not saying for 1 minute that they didn't go along with it. They did, but they didn't believe in it. And I'm thinking at the moment, with some of Ten Hag's tactics and approaches, or players at the moment thinking that this is not right, this is not going to work. And Gary Neville said, once that gets into your head, then it's a disaster. Once you start to, you know, not trust the manager's, you know, plans anymore, the manager's setup anymore, or his instructions, once you start to doubt that in your own head, then it's a recipe for disaster. I think it's possible that that's happening right now as well.
It could be, and you're right, Kyle, it's definitely a recipe for disaster. I mean, if the manager starts to lose the faith of the players, then yeah, you know, mentally, like Rio said, you know, even if you don't openly disobey what you're told to do, you're just not committed 100% because you have those doubts. I mean, we know how Ferguson dealt with those situations. It happened to him a few times too, and he had the power back in those days to say, as soon as a guy doubts me, he's gone. And so he always, you know, was able to maintain control. But when you have half a squad doubting you, you can't get rid of them all. And we know that it's a very different playing field that managers work in today. You know, they just don't have that level of control that Ferguson would have had. So yeah, that, you know, there is more vulnerability for managers there in terms of that happening and the players starting to down tools or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, just kind of lose faith in what the manager's saying. So yeah, it could be. I don't know, but I mean, it could be happening. And if it is, as you said, Kyle, it's a big, big problem that potentially can't be solved at all. But it'll be interesting to see how it kind of plays out for the rest of the season.
So I want to talk about Willy Kimwala now, who's making just his second start for Manchester United. I think he's made 9 appearances overall, but this being a second from the start. And given the opponents that we were playing against and how young he is, how inexperienced he is, I thought he did really, really well today. Extremely motivated young guy. He loves to orchestrate the crowd. He was doing that against Chelsea as well. One particular incident I remember when a Liverpool attacker got away from him. I think it might have been Diaz. And then he slid in. And Gary Neville was talking about how a young player, once he makes a mistake, he will try to make up for that mistake and then make another one. But when he slid in, he actually won the ball and it ended up, you know, deflecting into Onana's path for an easy catch. So yeah, so even when he made a mistake, he was able to get back and make up for it. Makes a lot of crucial blocks, and it was great to see that because it shows that he can read the game well, like Johnny Evans does. And you know, he's still only a teenager, really. But he looks to have a future. Now, we've talked about how Menu, Garnacho, and Hoyland are going to be the future of the club. Well, maybe we can add Kimwala to that list if he keeps going the way he's going.
Good young player. He looks good. That's the first I didn't get to see. All the Chelsea game and the other night properly. So yeah, I thought he was great today, Kyle. I really, really liked him. Like you said, he looked solid. He didn't stand out, similar to, you know, when a goalkeeper's playing well. You know, he didn't stand out as making any errors, unlike some other players who didn't look pretty very good today. So yeah, I thought he played well. Like you say, he looks athletic. He looks tenacious. As you mentioned there, you know, he makes mistakes. He seems to be keen to make up for them and not compounding them or losing the head, you know, doing it in a kind of a controlled way. So yeah, he just looks like a good young player. And you're right, Kyle, you know, he seems like somebody like we're starting to get now, you know, a few really good young players to look to be ones to build on for the and he definitely looks to be another one of them. Glad to see more of these, you know, what are looking like top class young people in the squad, and he seems to be another one of them. 100%, yeah, he looks really, really good.
Yeah, I think the likes of Varane and Lindelof are going to be moved on in the summer, and Johnny Evans will probably retire. It's likely that United are going to sign Jarrod Branthwaite from Everton. United are big fans of him. It's just a matter of agreeing a fee on that one. And you know, many of the supporters, understandably, have said we need to sign two centre backs in the summer, given, you know, the potential for three or four centre backs to leave. But then Kimwala might save us, you know, 60 million, you know, by him being the second centre half after signing Branthwaite. I always mentioned this before about Menu. I said Menu could save United £80 million, and he has. Absolutely. because, really? You know, a player from the, that's what, this is what you want. You want players from the academy coming in and fitting in perfectly into the first team. And it means that you don't have that need to go out and spend anymore. And yeah, so we might only need to sign one centre half in the summer if Kumbala is then going to be part of the squad. But that will be up to Ten Hag or whoever the manager is in the summer to decide that. And that is a nice wee segue onto that issue. Where are you at with Ten Hag at the moment, Chris? First of all, this is kind of a two-part question. What do you think should happen, in your opinion? And what do you think is going to happen with Ten Hag in the summer?
I'm going to answer it in reverse order. What I think is going to happen is, well, it'll all be results dependent, of course. I think if we finish outside the top four, I think he's gone. I think he's gone. He may be gone even if we do finish in the top four, because I won't be surprised. I'm seeing in Brailsford and Radcliffe that they want pretty much what they consider to be the best of the best in every facet. And I would be surprised if they've already decided that that's not Ten Hag and that he's gone regardless. So I think he may, if you were to put a gun to my head, I would say he's more likely to go. What I think should happen, I've said it for a long time, I think managers at Man United have been working with one hand tied behind their back, and I have an asterisk against the performance of every manager we've had since Ferguson for that reason. Ten Hag is the first person that I think is starting to work under what looks to be a better regime, but that regime's still developing, so you could say in a sense he's still working with a hand tied behind his back. But I think that yeah, if he's lost the players, as you say, Kyle, and there has been some things are up and down. Yeah, I mean, if he was sacked, I wouldn't fight it and be as vociferously as I have in the past. The one thing I would say is that, like every other manager, I don't think we even know the half of what they had to deal with and the half of where they were undermined or they asked for things they didn't get. So I still find it hard to say that some of the decisions we even think are obviously Ten Hag. They may not even have been Ten Hag. So that's my only thing. But Radcliffe and co will know that, so they will know what they can blame him for and what they can't. In a way, what I'm saying is I, for the first time in a long time, have faith in the people at the club to actually make the right decision. I couldn't have said that for a long time, but I feel like maybe, just maybe, we have those people now. So I feel like whatever happens, hopefully I will have faith this time that it's the right thing. That's a long-winded answer, but yeah, I guess what I'm saying is whatever does happen, I'm hoping will actually be the right thing this time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the thing that makes me doubt him is what we've talked about already, is the tactics on the setup on match days and every single game now. It just seems like a recipe for chaos and not a recipe for consistent results. And results have not been good. We haven't actually won a game since the Liverpool FA Cup match 3 weeks ago. We talked about how if we were going to finish in the Champions League spots, we had to basically win every match and couldn't afford to drop many points. We haven't won any of our last three league games now, and this is not going to be looked upon. Like, the board aren't going to look upon Ten Hag favorably when they're assessing these games. You and I also were watching the Fulham game together, which United lost 2-1, which was another game where we were told by reliable journalists that Radcliffe and co were not impressed by what they saw that day. So he's effectively on trial, and
absolutely
he's not really passing that trial at the moment. Like everybody in this show has said, including myself, new owners or new co-owners, they always bring in their own man. And even if they don't do it right away, they will do it eventually. And he's just not doing enough to convince me, or and probably not them, that he is worth keeping for another year. The only thing that might save him is the lack of viable alternatives. But I just don't know. It's hard to say at the moment. Winning the FA Cup might help him. But Radcliffe did make a point in that round of interviews he did when his partial takeover was official. He said how important it was to qualify for the Champions League because it gives us more revenue in the transfer market, especially with the PSR rules. And if Ten Hag isn't meeting that kind of basic requirement, then I can see him being moved on in the summer, even if he does win the FA Cup. Now, famously, Louis van Gaal, our last Dutch manager, was sacked after winning the FA Cup. I mean, he wasn't even allowed to celebrate it. He was coming into the press room with the trophy, and the journalists couldn't wait to tell him that Mourinho was going to be Manchester United's next manager, which was very, very harsh, I have to say.
But it was.
The same thing could happen to Ten Hag. Another similarity has been the amount of injuries that United had this season. Once again, McTominay missed the game through injury today. And this happened under Van Gaal as well. And it has been well documented that training is very, very intense. And I think it's led to a lot of muscular injuries. Plaistri had mentioned this. He's now on loan at Granada. In an interview he done in Spain, he said that after United training sessions, he felt exhausted and he couldn't even walk. I mean, Casemiro was picking up muscular injuries and he never did at Real Madrid. And there's only been three players all season who haven't had an injury. I think it's 56 separate cases now of players missing games through injury or illness this season. And Ten Hag always denied that his training is intense. But journalists are saying otherwise. And he's not the only manager who does it. I think Eddie Howe does it. He's experienced a lot of muscular injuries. Pochettino as well. But it's been well documented that Pep Guardiola actually only does light sessions during the week. And that seems to work for him. Jurgen Klopp is another manager who does intense training sessions. And they have obviously experienced a lot of injuries this season. So to me, it probably makes more sense that, especially if you've got two games a week, just to do light sessions in between. And don't kill people and run them into the ground. Look what's happened to Martinez. Got injured in September, was out until January. Because back in January, he does really well. Then he gets another injury in February, albeit it was a bit of a freak one because a player landed on him. Then he's out for 8 weeks, comes back against Brentford for was only a sub appearance. Then all of a sudden he picks up a calf injury in training and he's out again. And you're like, this is just unbelievable. So he's had three separate injuries. And I was looking at the stats at Ajax. He didn't have this amount of injuries. It just would have to happen when he comes to Manchester United. I would say it is a high possibility that the training methods are a contributing factor. They're not solely to blame, but I would say that the intense training is a problem.
Yeah, I don't know, obviously. Yeah, without being in there, knowing what's going on behind closed doors, I'm not sure how intense it is, Kyle. But yeah, I'm sure it's not helping. The interesting thing about it too is if we're training so intensely, it's not translating to high pressure, pressing football on the pitch. So you kind of wonder why then are we, if we are training that intensely, for what reason? What benefit are we getting from it? Do you know what I mean? If it is intense, you'd think I could see that that Klopp's would be intense because, you know, they often, you know, over the years have played really high octane, high pressing football and similar actually with City, although, you know, they're more obviously possession based, but they still do press really hard. So I could see a rationale. If you want your team to be super fit and press the ball all the time, then you want to push them hard. But we don't play that kind of play that. Sure, what the aim of it is, bar having, I mean, it would be fit anyway. You know, by the nature of generally professional, you know, kind of training is going to keep them fit. So I mean, and I don't know. I mean, in terms of like Casemiro, obviously age is a factor. You know, he was at Madrid, he was younger. You know, he's now older now. With every year passing, he becomes more injury prone. That's just a fact of life. So I don't know if there's a relationship with that or not. But yeah, I mean, if it is causing injuries, then it's something that needs to be looked at. And again, if it is the training, then that comes down to the manager, and that's his. He kind of has to take the blame for that. I thought that recently, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Kai, that I read something where maybe a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, that somebody actually asked Ten Hag, and he said that he knows the cause of the injuries. And then they asked him, well, what is the cause? And he says, I'm not telling you, as if to insinuate there was some particular factor that he now become aware of that was the reason for these injuries. And maybe I picked that up wrong. If that's true, then yeah, interesting. As if he's trying to say it's a particular thing or person or scenario, whatever it is, that he thinks can be fixed. So if that is the case, well, then remains to be seen if it does improve. But it's getting to the time now, it's probably too late. You know, the injuries that we've had have probably impacted our season to one degree or another. So can't make up for that lost time, I don't think. But yeah, I mean, if it is the case and it is too intense and it is the cause of injuries, well, then the manager has to take the blame for that. But yeah.
And it's not speculative, Danny. This has been well reported by journalists who have well sourced information that Ten Hag, his training sessions are very, very intense. And I remember Van Gaal was famous for his double sessions in one day. So it seems to be a Dutch thing, you know, killing players and running them into the ground to make them fit. So this is not me plucking this out of the air. This is, you know, reliable journalists who report on Manchester United every single day have this information, and they're all saying the same thing. They've even questioned Ten Hag about it. So obviously he's tried to play it down. So I'm not speculating. I'm talking about well-sourced information. And he's talking about Ferran's issue with concussion. He doesn't like heading balls anymore, apparently. But Ferran seems to be making a lot of excuses now. And I'm thinking this is a guy who's winding down his career. And I don't think, with him having that kind of mentality, I don't think he's the right man to have at the club. It's not the first time that Varane has mentioned something, and I've thought, you know, his heart's not really in it. He's thinking about retirement. Of course, he's already retired from international football. But yeah, it seems as if Varane doesn't want to head the ball anymore. I know he does, obviously, but the way he's talking, he doesn't want to because he's had concussion issues, apparently, and which is, he says, has caused him to miss games. But it wasn't concussion that led to him being substituted in the previous two games at halftime. Definitely not the Brentford one. He picked up a knock in a collision with another player, and that's been the issue with him. He's just too injury prone.
I see him just reading, Kyle. I'm seeing that Ten Hag did mentioned something, and actually he says it's the workload on top footballers is too high, and that standards are dropping when key players are ruled out because of injury. So he's blaming almost the schedule, which we hear Klopp talking about frequently as well. So it sounds like actually that's what he said. We don't train too hard. We need to be fit with the standards in this league. You need to be fit. Otherwise you can't match the standards that games require, but we're not training too hard. So he has come out and tried to say, but obviously without seeing the sessions himself, I don't know. But I fully get what you're saying, Kyle. And if journalists have reported it, then there's obviously some people think it. But yeah, he's come out and defended against it, apparently.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's what I mean by he's denying it. But he's obviously going to say that. He's not going to come out and say, yeah, my sessions have been too hard and that's led to all the injuries. You know, he was never going to say that, was he? Let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's hard, like I say, it is hard to know. It seems like certainly some people think it. But once again, you know, it's in a way, if that is the case, then it's almost again a problem for Radcliffe and co. to address. And again, you know, I guess we'll see then next season if Ten Hag's not the manager anymore, is it, and we have a similar squad, which obviously we'll have at least most of the players will remain. You know, will the kind of injuries continue? But it has been pretty bad. And interestingly, like you said, I mean, I don't know. You said it's a Dutch thing. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. But I do remember the season that we had Van Gaal, that there was a lot of injuries that year too. I remember correctly, that was one of the main reasons Rashford got his debut when he did, is because we were so short in players. So certainly we'll have seen it before, and it definitely has been again. And it serves to undermine the manager, because you bring in good players. The main example probably being Martinez, who we love, and we may as well not assign him because he's injured all the time. So if it is something systematic, it absolutely needs to be addressed for sure. Yeah, so yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, Martinez on at least two separate occasions should have been eased back in and not absolutely killed in training, if that's what's happened. There's no way after him just coming back for one sub-appearance that he then picks up another muscular injury and has to be sidelined again. I just couldn't believe that news that Martinez and Lindelof are now going to be out for a month. I seen the Lindelof one coming because he pulled his hamstring during the game, but Martinez so soon after being back, I just had my head in my hands at that one. Danny mentioned the medical department, and I know that Gary Driscoll, who was the former physio at or club doctor at Arsenal and for England, he's now at United, and he's been tasked with appointing his own medical department. So there's been a lot of hiring and firing going on there, and I think he's in charge of that. So
I just gonna say, Kyle, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I agree with what Danny's saying. And again, it comes back to, you know, if to make one sweeping statement, which in some ways I think maybe covers it all, you know, the football side of Manchester United has been neglected for so long, as we know. And to us, you fans watching games, you think of the football department as the players and the coaching staff and the manager. But you know, there's a lot more to it than that. And you know, everybody's job feeds into the performance on the pitch, and it's extremely important, and that includes the likes of the medical department and you know, the staff who are making the meals and the kind of food that people are getting and all those other things. You know, so there's, if those things aren't right, those all will contribute to poor performance. So I think that, again, you know, that's the sort of things that Radcliffe and Brailsford have said we'll be looking at, is it's the things that we don't see but are actually having as much impact on what's happening on the pitch as the things that we do see. And I think that, you know, it's a fair thing to say, as Danny said, and if you said yourself, Kyle, that, you know, other areas that are involved in the football side, like the medical department, have probably been below standard as well for a long time. And fixing those things will improve things on the pitch too, for sure.
Yeah, it's probably been neglected. As we know, the Glazers just wanted to spend the absolute bare minimum they could get away with.
Exactly.
And Ryan here says, the subs were a joke today. Brought on Mount and Amrabat for Garnacho and Menu and killed the attack. 3-1 was there for us. Ten Hag fault for choosing to sit back. We can't defend a lead. And that's right. How many times have United lost points from a winning position, even in the last few games? And the substitutions probably haven't helped that. I mean, Amrabat coming on for Garnacho, he obviously, you can see what he had in mind there. He wanted to see out the game and play for the 2-1. Mourinho would have done something similar, but it just never works. He should have just stuck to the chaos football.
I agree. I think if you were to ask me what approach I think is best, it's like you said, Kai, Mourinho would have done the same thing. You can see the logic in it. Maybe we don't actually have the personnel. Maybe that's part of the problem, is we don't, particularly again, coming back to the problem with injuries, having the injuries that we do, we don't have the depth necessarily to be able to have the players to actually comfortably see out a lead when you make those changes. You know, Amrabat, as we know, you know, isn't probably, you know, with grace or respect, you know, top level. He's not what you'd want to, you know, build a team around, you know, at Manchester United's kind of level. And Wan-Bissaka, as we talked about earlier, although he was on from the start, but you know, individual error, that again comes down to a person. That was a personal mistake. And the fact that Wan-Bissaka is one of our players on the pitch is why that mistake was made. So I do agree with the approach in terms of trying to shut up shop. But unfortunately, we don't have the players to do it. So maybe it was better to just keep on pressing forward, leave Garnacho on, and just, you know, attack in the best form of defence. So, yeah.
Well, the evidence is there that we can't hold on to leads. But as you say, it was an individual error that led to the equalising goal. And Wan-Bissaka doesn't go to ground there, then maybe we do win the game. But that's twice in a row now Garnacho's been taken off when he's been our biggest threat on the counter-attack. Against Chelsea, he was the man of the match. The most bizarre situation that I've come across was when Garnacho was given man of the match against Chelsea, just shortly after he was substituted, and then it was after full time the man of the match was changed to Cole Palmer because United just couldn't see out the game from a winning position. Because United lost a game which they were winning after 99 minutes, the broadcaster had to change the man of the match. Have you ever come across that in your life?
No.
So, but
I know. Yeah. Sorry.
But just get back to the point in hand. I didn't agree with Garnacho being taken off in either games, either the Chelsea game or the Liverpool game. Because the chaos bubble was working. United were 2-1 up. Just keep doing it. As soon as you change the plans, then you're allowing Liverpool to have the initiative then. And then they could have ended up winning the game. And that's another point well made here about Ahmad. Ahmad, of course, got the winner against Liverpool in the FA Cup game. He hasn't played since. He was suspended against Brentford for being sent off in that Liverpool game, but was not used against Chelsea and not used again today. Don't understand that. He must feel very, very aggrieved that he hasn't even made it on as a sub. Scored the winner against Liverpool and hasn't been seen since. Bizarre from the manager again. I think Nigel, who's been on this podcast, said that Ahmad will be the new Pellistri. He will be a player which the fans want to see more often, but a player that Ten Hag will not use. And Donna here says, I agree. However, he should never have been taken off against Chelsea. That is correct. But today he says Garnacho wasn't feeling himself, hence the sub, and Liverpool was dominating possession in the middle of the pitch. So I get why he made that sub. Yeah, the problem is that Amrabat has been very poor since he came to United, as you say, Chris, but he's another one of those signings that Ten Hag has had at a previous club. You tracked in this case and did well at the World Cup, did reasonably well for Fiorentina, so Ten Hag decided to bring him in. And that's been another issue, of course, that Ten Hag has been given like almost a free rein in the transfer market, and a lot of his signings are players that he's trusted in the past, and that's proved to be a mistake in Amrabat's case.
My only thing, and I've said this before, and I'm hoping that I can stop talking about it after this summer, that we actually start having a better kind of set of decision makers making decisions on recruitment, etc. But my issue and the caveat with me is more about trust, that I've said before, Kyle, is who he is making these signings. I know, not saying that it seems on the face of it really obvious that, oh, these are guys that Ten Hag worked with. They must be the people that he wanted, and he trumped everybody else's opinion. But I'm not so sure that's the case. And the fact that I don't trust the decision makers, is there's a part of my mind that says, are they just the people that actually he thought he was able to get because he worked with him before, and that in fact it was so chaotic in terms of making decisions that he just went with what he thought was a safer bet because he didn't trust the scouting department, or there was so much disagreement. I feel like there's so many unanswered questions that even though it is straightforward, and it is, he made the decisions and that was it. But knowing the chaos that's been around United for such a long time up until now, I'm not even sure that those were even his first choices. Maybe they were just the most, what he was seen as the most attainable or most gettable players, and not the ones he really wanted. But again, I could be wrong, but the fact that there is a doubt in my mind, I think, says it all. And again, hoping that now the new regime will remove that doubt and will actually have a professional process in place there where you can be maybe confident that actually the players that are coming in are players that the manager does want, as opposed to maybe his third choice. Yeah, I guess I've just lost faith up until now.
Yeah, but it has been well documented by The Athletic, who don't do bullshit, that Ten Hag only agreed to take the job if he had a big, big say in the signings that Manchester United were making. And apparently that is in his contract to some degree. And he will have to agree to relinquish that power if he's going to stay on, because as we know, the whole structure is changing. There's going to be a director of football, a technical director, and they're essentially going to be in charge of recruitment, and he's going to be a head coach. So, him being in charge of signings, apparently he's had more control of signings than anyone else before him and after Fergie.
But the caveat in my mind is I'm not. So I believe that there's no player, given what you said, Kyle, I think you're right. And what I think that means, though, is that there's been no player forced upon him that he didn't say yes to. But that still doesn't mean that he got the exact players in each position that he wanted. he maybe isn't getting players that he doesn't want at all, but he might not be getting his first choice either. And knowing how poor not even recruitment has been, but negotiating recruitment has been, and how United over the years seemingly can't manage to get a good deal on anybody and get ripped off every time they put their hand in their pocket, that makes me unsure that he actually got who he wanted. He maybe didn't get somebody that he absolutely didn't want, but still might have been his third choice. Choice number one, number two didn't come off. And that's what I'm trying to say, is he might have got what he thought they'll do, and I don't dislike them, as opposed to, he's my number one target. I'm not sure if he's got his number one targets. That's the doubt that I have in my mind.
Well, he certainly didn't get him Harry Kane, which he wanted, that's for sure. But they pulled out of that one in June last year. They didn't even make an attempt to get him. But undoubtedly, I think it's because Tottenham did not want to sell to a Premier League rival and wanted to sell him abroad. If United would have had to pay a lot more money than Bayern for that signing, no doubt about that one.
As Ryan says, or De Jong's another one exactly who 100% wanted and didn't get. So, like I say, I don't think he ever got anybody he didn't want, but he did not get his first choice on a number of occasions. And they're the two that we know of. There's been more. And that's,
if we could just deal with that one, that was not United's fault at all. United actually agreed a deal with Barcelona, and De Jong would not come to United because he wanted Barcelona to give him a payoff. So there's nothing more United could have done in that situation.
That's a fair point, Kyle, but it still leaves Ten Hag in the same position where he doesn't get his first choice and has to make do, and that's the problem. And that's what I'm hoping is going to change in this new regime, is whoever the manager is, when they ask for somebody, as long as they're within budget, the club actually manages to get it over the line and they get who they want and they think they need. And then if they have that, then it's completely wrong because they got what they wanted. I'm not sure up to now that's happened.
Said, the manager now, from what we're being told by almost everybody in the know, is that the manager is going to have minimal say now when it comes to the transfer market. He might have, like Jurgen Klopp, he might be able to make suggestions, but he's just going to be given players now to work with, but there'll be players that fit his style. And that's what happens in most clubs now. That's the modern approach. You know, managers are not recruiters anymore. So it'll be interesting to see if Ten Hag is, if the owners do decide to keep him, is he happy to go along with that? Because I believe that he's interested in a Dutch forward who plays for Dortmund on a potential swap deal involving Jadon Sancho. But United hierarchy have very much said, absolutely not. And I can understand that. I certainly do not want Ten Hag to be bringing in any more of his favourites from the Dutch league. That's for sure, because for the most part, they haven't really worked out. And that's certainly not going to happen anymore. So I want to come to these comments. There's been a few more. Danny says he fully expects Ahmad and Mount to play in the coming games against Bournemouth, Coventry, Sheffield United and Burnley. I think Mason Mount, might have a chance of starting a couple of those games, but the evidence so far tells me that Ahmad could be made to wait for another chance. He should have been rewarded for scoring that winning goal against Liverpool. We've seen even today how hard it is to beat Liverpool. So the fact that the guy scored a winner in the 121st minute under pressure was so cool in that scenario, with the magnitude of the game and how much it meant to everybody at the club and how much it meant to Liverpool, for him to just coolly slot that away past the keeper and so late in a massive game showed that not only is he good, you know, from an ability standpoint, but he's also got it upstairs as well. So I think he definitely deserves more of a chance, Ahmad Diallo. Donny says, especially if Rashford's picked up an injury. Yeah, that's right. Rashford got injured today. There'll be one or two people who won't be disappointed by that, given the form that he's been in.
Myself included.
We obviously don't wish injury on anyone, but sometimes when players are out of form, then you're not that, you know, bothered about it. Like when Lindelof was when it was announced that he was out for a month, I don't think anybody was shedding too many tears over that one. Ryan here says, we know he wanted Kane De Jong and we didn't get them, which we just talked about. And Danny here says, he had to sign loan players, that in itself is worrying regardless of his first choice targets. Yeah, because another issue at United is the managing the budget. Because they spent so much money on just three targets in Hoyland, Mason Mount, and the goalkeeper, then they were getting Johnny Evans on a free, Amrabat on loan, because there's no more money to spend, especially given the PSR rules. We're very, very careful not to break those, because we've seen Aberdeen and Forest end up with points deductions, and United were very, very close to the line there. But that's another issue with that, is that they're so poor at selling players as well, which I'm hoping is going to improve this summer. I want to see United get good money for the players that they want to sell, because that just hasn't happened at all, really. And I mean, the only players we made a profit on is Dan James and Diddy Blind since Ferguson retired. That's absolutely disgraceful.
That's shocking. I mean, you know, for any other business, you know, that considers himself to be a serious business, to perform that poorly in the transfer market, you know, with incomings and outgoings, is absolutely shocking. As we've talked about lots and lots of times, Kyle, painting themselves in their corner, overpaying. You know, I hear people say to me all the time, supporters of other clubs, when I say about, you know, this, the playing staff that we have, people will always say, oh, but look at the amount of money we've spent, but we've misspent it. I mean, even Richard Arnold, I think, said it in that video where he was talking to fans, you know, that we don't have the value on the pitch of what's actually been spent. I mean, it's been nothing short of appalling. So yeah, it's been really, really bad. Yeah, as Danny says, need to start shipping players out and balancing the books. I mean, that, again, you would think that a professional club of the standard of and the level of Manchester United would have that down to a fine art, you know, that business side of buying and selling players, but seemingly they've just always come off on the worst of it. So again, I can't imagine that Radcliffe and co will do anything but try and sort that out. So you expect that to improve as well, starting from this summer, I would think.
Yeah, no way do I believe that United are going to win the Premier League next season. Probably not even next 3 or 4 years.
It's hard to see. I mean, yeah, there's no way in hell it's going to happen next year. Absolutely not. Probably not the year after either. Probably realistically, I think didn't even Radcliffe himself say it. He thought it was a 3-year project or something. But yeah, there's no way. We're too far behind. But that said, there are some glimpses of light, like you said, Kyle, on the playing side, Cobby Mainoo, Garnacho, Kamwala, you know, Fernandez, for all his flaws, the quality he has. You know, Onana's starting to look a bit more solid. Hoyland's a good young player. I do think we have the makings of a good team there, and the fact that we can, you know, go up against Liverpool today, who are, you know, winning the league and come out and get a draw against them. Yes, they were the better team, but that tells me we're not absolutely millions of miles away. We're not relegation, you know, fought or anything like that. But I don't think that we've still got a good bit of catch up to be played. So I can't see it happening for a couple of years. Two, probably three is realistic at the earliest, I would think.
Yeah, in 3 years' time, I want us to be what Arsenal are now. And the reason why I make that comparison is because it's taken time for them to get to this point. And you just have to be patient to get there. They're probably a club on a similar budget to Manchester United. They're not a club on steroids like Manchester City. Arsenal are quite similar to us. Our stadium is slightly bigger, but they have a massive global fan base as well. And you know, similar revenue streams. I would like us to do what they're doing, almost kind of copy some of the things that they're doing. They've obviously brought in a young, very young manager and given him time, but he's had the structure above him there with Edu, I think it is the director of football, and been very much in charge of recruitment, and they've gotten the recruitment spot on. And another thing they did was they got rid of the players who bad apples, if you like, or players who weren't pulling their weight, like Aubameyang and Mesut Ozil and so on, who big high earners who weren't going to be part of the future. They moved them on, and United need to be ruthless like that as well. You see, I think I said this yesterday as well. You see, United players who've been at the club for 4 or 5 years, they've had their chance. Move them on. They're not going to do it. They're not going to be part of a successful team. Now, players who are just in the door, and especially the ones that are doing well, by all means, keep them. But you see players who've been around a long time and they've just not done it or won anything. It's time to move them on. You need to be ruthless. So I'm just going to come go ahead.
Sorry, Kyle, it was just to say that unfortunately circles back to the problem we put ourselves into, is that even when we recognise players that need to go, can't actually get rid of them because they're on stupid, ridiculous wages and nobody else will pay it. So again, you know, it's going to take time as well for those players to filter out. The way it's going to have to happen is that the contracts that they refuse to step away from, we can't move them on while they're in them, those contracts will be run down and we'll just have to release them. So I think for some people have to be the route as opposed to selling them, because nobody's going to take them on, and that's again a problem that's been created over the years, per business.
Yeah, a couple of things that would be helpful in that scenario is that Martial is out of contract, and
exactly
Casemiro and Varane, they're attracting interest from Saudi Arabia, so and they can afford their wages, so there's an opportunity to move those players on. And get the wages off.
As Danny said, Maguire is the exact example I have in my mind. 100%. Maguire is the example. And Maguire, fair play to him. He's sort of semi turned things around. But it looked like he was going to go. Everybody was happy for him to go. And he couldn't afford to go because he wouldn't pay his wages. And that's the problem that we've created, unfortunately. But yeah, it'll change over time.
The thing is, we can't get rid of absolutely every centre back. And if Maguire remains as a backup, then I'm okay with that. You know, it's not a disaster. You know, Lindelof is being seen as a sellable asset this summer. Clubs in Europe would love to have him. Varane is going to be moved on. Johnny Evans will retire. I don't think we can get rid of Maguire as well, you know, considering so many people are potentially leaving.
I totally agree. I don't think Maguire necessarily would be the first one out the door anymore. That's changed. But it's just this making the point that that Maguire is an example of the situation business wise that we're in, where some players that you want to go won't go because the clubs will pay them and they'll just have to run a contract down. But yeah, it'll happen over time.
I know that Ryan was asking our thoughts on Ten Hag's future. We covered that earlier in the show, if you want to go back and check that out. But let's get to the player ratings. Andre Onana had a good day today, no doubt about that. So I'll say a 7 out of 10. I wish he'd have guessed right for that Salah penalty. We might have got the points, you know, not blaming him, but that would have been an easy save for him if he went the other way, you know. But these things are all about luck. Dalot, much improved on Thursday night. You know, the only way it was up after that performance. So 6 out of 10. Kambala has to be a 7. You have to factor in how young he is as well and the magnitude of the game, you know, when you're scoring players. So magnificent full home debut by Kambala. Maguire, yeah, like you say, he's turned it around. He's a completely different position where he was a year ago. So, and today he didn't look out of place. Like there's no incident in my head where I'm thinking, oh, Maguire was awful there. He made a dreadful error. You know, if you're not noticing him, then that's good. You know, so 6, I would say, for Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka. Yeah, probably the principal reason why we didn't win the game. And had an awful day at the office, so probably a 2 out of 10. Casemiro, very, very up and down performance again. Passing, it was a bit off. People go past him too easily now. He dived into a challenge at the end there, which if it was a few inches higher, he would have been another red card for him. Yeah, he's just a player that looks as if his best days are behind him, which is unfortunate because he was so good last season. But Father Time seemed to have just hit him all of a sudden. He cannot understate how good he was last season. And the drop-off has been enormous. And at 33 next season, he's not going to recover his best form again. So I think now would be the time to move him on. So I would say a 4 for Casemiro. Kobbie Mainoo, unbelievable goal again. And just, you just run out of adjectives, really, when you're talking about him now. You know, what more can you say? And I think he turns 19 at the end of the month. That's how young he is. Could you imagine how good he's going to be when he's 22?
He's absolutely super. If I'm honest, I've seen him have better games, I thought, generally, than what he had today. There was a couple of times I think he was dispossessed in that. Now, that says more about how good Liverpool are. But even when I thought he's not having his best day, then he just turns up and scores a goal of absolute top-drawer quality. And you just remember, the guy is young and he's absolutely brilliant and he's only going to get better. Yeah, he's class.
Yeah, as an all-round performance, the FA Cup game against Liverpool was much better. He was the best player on the pitch that day by a country mile. But today,
totally agree.
It was more about his goal than his overall performance. Even Jurgen Klopp said it was an amazing goal. He didn't try to blame his defence or say it was lucky or anything like that. He just admitted that it was a brilliant goal. So 7 out of 10 for Menu. Marcus Rashford, very, very disappointing. Once again, another thing that I've mentioned so often with Rashford is head down and runs into a cul-de-sac. Tried to beat too many players in one particular incident. It was when we were attacking the Stratford end. I think it was Garnacho and Hoyland were in the middle, waiting for the pullback. And he, rather than just play it to them, he tries to beat another man and he loses the ball. Now, that's just Rashford all over. And it's just so frustrating.
It's hard to watch at the minute. He just doesn't have any output these days. You know, I've said it before. At times, he just looks to me, like you say, can't put his head down. It's almost like he's trying too hard. You know, you see him on the ball and you're thinking he just wants to run the length of the pitch and score. You know, it's just that desperation or something. Sometimes I see in him, he's just not calm and making good decisions. He's not playing well at the minute.
Yeah, and I don't think this is ever going to change because he's 26 now. You know, he's not 18. You know, he's a very experienced player now and he still has those flaws to his game. And yeah, he looks to be injured now as well. I don't know how long he's going to be out. Generally, when he gets injured, he sometimes comes back for the next game. To be honest with you, based on Thursday night, Anthony should have started this game and not Rashford. And in my opinion, and it's just speculative, but I think that the manager is afraid to upset Rashford and Bruno Fernandes. You know, he's fallen out with a number of players. Some of them have left, some of them quite big names in the world of football. And because his position now is so uncertain, he's afraid to fall out with anyone else, in my opinion. And you obviously, Bruno and Rashford are two of our most senior players. So he said, quite clearly, he dropped Rashford against Chelsea, but he tried to portray it as he was rotating. Well, when you rotate, you make 5 or 6 changes. That was the only change he made. So he was dropped. And then he just a very small rotation. Yeah, and then he brings him back in today when Anthony deserved to start ahead of him. I just think he's afraid to upset him now. So Rashford would get a 3 out of 10 for his performance. Haaland, quite anonymous again today. Unfortunately, was in such great form before he got injured, and now he struggled to recover that form. It's really killed his momentum, hasn't it? But then again, the service is almost non-existent.
Yeah, he was all right. There was a couple of times he was kind of pressing up with the ball, and I was sort of, again, I thought he made a couple of poor decisions with, you know, people running, kind of runners coming off him, and I thought he's going to need to sort of lay it off one way or the other, and he kind of maybe made the wrong decision. But yeah, like you said, and Danny said in the chat there, he didn't get a lot of service. I don't think he had many kind of options to get involved really today, but he hasn't been playing as well as what he was, you're right, Kai, before he got injured. He was really looking like he was on a really good trajectory, and he's kind of stalled a wee bit, unfortunately. But again, he's young. I think he will eventually recover.
You see, we've talked about the lack of service a lot this season, and that is a valid point. But when he was in that vein of form between Boxing Day and the end of February, where he almost scored in basically every game, he's creating chances for himself. Totally. But he's lost that at the moment now. He's lost that edge to his game. he's gone back to relying on other people. And, you know, even his touch looks a wee bit off. You know, he's not controlling the ball the way he was whenever he was in a confident mood. So hopefully he can recover his form. Unfortunately, the injury really stunted his momentum, and I was fearing that was going to happen. But he was all, as a young player, he's going to have peaks and troughs. Like he's not going to be consistent at this point in his career. So Hoyland, we get a 5, and Bruno Fernandes, scoring that goal from the halfway line. Another up and down performance from himself. But you know, I once see his, and this happened in the cup game as well. Well, there's a Liverpool counter attack, and Fernandes is the furthest man back for United. He's the one making the goal and saving challenge. You know, I don't know how the number 10 finds himself in that situation. But then again, Cavani used to do that. I remember Cavani, even in the Europa League final. You know, we all talked about how lazy Pogba was. Cavani was, I remember in the Europa League final, Cavani was running, sprinting past Pogba to make a tackle.
It's crazy. But crazy but unsurprising. Kind of sums the two of them up in a nutshell in some ways, I would say. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, at times Cavani would find himself being the last man, last line of defence. Yeah, unbelievable. How we'd love to have signed that guy when he was in his mid-20s. He not only did he have the work rate, but he had the ability, had just absolutely everything you'd want in a centre forward.
He was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I loved him when he came to United. I was strange. Actually, when I seen him play years ago, Kyle, I actually thought he needed too many chances to score. And I rated him highly, but I never thought he was at absolute elite level. But when he came to United and I saw him, you know, week in, week out, my appreciation for him just skyrocketed. He was just brilliant. He was super professional, great quality, read the game unbelievably well, great finisher. Oh, he was just brilliant. Yeah, you're right. I just wish we got him 5 or 6, 7 years earlier. Yeah, he was just great.
Yeah, just the absolute model professional as well. So Bruno, I'll give him a 7 for his performance. The substitutions, Anthony came on after 66 and Mason Mount 84, Amrabat 79. There weren't none of them really on for very long. It was Anthony who was on long enough to have an impact, and didn't really have the desired impact, but I have to say he put in a lot of effort. You know, when you see how Rashford's fans make excuses for him that, you know, forwards don't like to defend, but when you watch Garnacho and Anthony play, you see the difference it can make when a wide forward tracks back or presses, and Rashford just doesn't want to do that. He's just not interested. So
100%. 100%. I think I say this to you a lot, Kyle. I know that we've had a lot of discussions on this podcast in the past about Anthony, and I know Anthony, there's a lot of people really didn't like him for a long time, and I can see his flaws for sure. But that was the one thing that I did always compliment him on, was say that he works really hard, and he does work really hard. And I've always said that I can see why Ten Hag likes him, because he knows he's going to get a shift out of him. Sometimes the quality's not there, and sometimes it's a bit predictable. I totally, totally get that. And he looks like he's not maybe worth the money that was paid for him, but it was, in my opinion, too much, more than what he was worth regardless. But he does, he puts in a shift, and you're right, there's nothing worse than a player like, yeah, who's got lots of ability and just a little bit of a shift. I mean, you know, putting in the shift should be the minimum. Ability, yeah, you hope it comes along with it too at this level. But yeah, Anthony works hard, and you're right, it highlights other players who don't, and that's really not good enough. You know, everybody at Manchester United, you know, should realise the privilege to be there, and they should be absolutely playing at a 100% level at all times. That's the minimum requirement, really.
Yeah. Do you see when you're just strolling around, you just look like an egomaniac. You think he's above everybody else. I just hate to see that. So,
and unless you're Dimitar Berbatov, and that's just how you play.
Yeah, I mean, he gets away with it because his touch is so immaculate. I mean, I could watch Instagram videos all day of Berbatov's touch, because they're just so sublime. Brilliant.
Absolutely sublime. Yeah, sublime.
And so, something a 6 for his cameo, and Ten Hag, I'll give him a 5 out of 10 for today. We drew the game, and we should have won. And there's an argument that his substitutions didn't work, and obviously his setup, the shape of the team, and the tactics are very questionable. I was just looking at the tagline for the Gary Neville podcast, and it says, "Neville frustrated by schoolboy Man United after Liverpool draw." I think that about sums it up, really, doesn't it?
It does sum it up, and it's exactly it. Amateur schoolboy. Yeah, that's it. Just two moments of poor, stuff that you would just not want to see at that level. Cost us the game today. We should have won it, really. I don't think we deserved to win it overall. I think actually overall Liverpool were probably slightly better. But given that we were actually leading the game, and given that the two goals we conceded were so schoolboy, we probably could have won it. It's a shame, really.
By the way, are you in a different time zone? Because it seemed to get dark a lot quicker where you are than where I am.
I think maybe I am, Kyle. I think it's just that poor lighting.
Yeah, because I was thinking, are you in England or something? Because it seemed to get dark a lot quicker than it did here, and you're only about 20 miles away or something.
I'm actually in the USA, Kyle. I just didn't like to say I'm on holiday. I wish. Unfortunately not.
I think we all wish that one. Maybe we'll join the preseason tour in the US this summer.
All right.
I wonder who the United manager is going to be during the preseason tour. That's the question that we will have answered in due course. And we will keep an eye on the likes of David Ornstein and Fabrizio Romano, because they will probably provide the answers first before we know. That USA solar eclipse, yeah. Neville certainly didn't hold back today, that's for sure. Some United fans were accusing Neville of arse-licking Liverpool and Arsenal and City too much this season and being too critical of United. But number one, the criticism is deserved. And two, if you've seen ComCam today, you'd have seen Neville celebrating the United goals. So he's just being honest about it. You know, you can't expect Neville to praise mediocrity, you know. No.
At the end of the day, too, he cares about Man United. You know, he's a United fan, obviously. He loves them. He's going to be more passionate, and his criticism is going to be more severe about United. But like you said, Kyle, he's going to celebrate the good things much more heavily, too, because, you know, he's a United fan. So, yeah, expect him to be passionate in both ways, for sure.
Okay, guys, we shall leave it there for today. I really enjoyed the discussion today, Chris, and it's been a pleasure having you on, as always.
Thank you, Kyle. You too. Really enjoyed it as always, mate. Chat to you soon. Take care.
Okay, I'll see you later. Bye.